Okay, I wonder if you ever heard the following words, something like this being said. It's important to have some kind of faith. We all worship the same God. It doesn't matter what you believe, so long as you don't hurt anyone. Or, God hasn't done anything for me, so why should I pay any attention to him? I'd be surprised if you haven't heard any words like that at some point, because that's what most people think. A lot of people think that way, at least in our culture. But here we see what God thinks about those things. And we're going to, I'm not going to do anything fancy, I'm just going to take you through the verses, through the story as we read it in the Bible. And we're going to see and explore what's going on here. But firstly, the background to this. So if you've been with us over the last few weeks, you will know that we've been looking at the previous chapters in Exodus. And what's been happening is God has been telling Moses exactly how he wants them to make something called the tabernacle, which is going to be a series of items and a tent that are at the center of God's relationship with his people. But just before that, in chapter 24, we read the following words. This is chapter 24 and verse 13, which is page 135. It says, Moses set out with Joshua, his assistant, and Moses went up on the mountain of God. He said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back to you. Aaron and Hur are with you, and anyone involved in a dispute can go to them. When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. So there they are, they're waiting. Moses has gone up the mountain, and they're waiting for him to come back, except they're not. They've got fed up, and if we look at verse 1, you see, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron. That's the only reason we're directly given for what they do next. What happens is they're fed up. Moses has been gone for ages and ages. We don't know what's happened to him. So what are we going to do? What they do next, what they say next, is interesting. They say, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. So they forget that God has brought them out of Egypt. And they don't even mention God here. What they're saying is Moses brought us out of Egypt. He was a man. You know, we might be grateful for that, but he's gone up this mountain, and we don't know what's happened to him. The implication is we don't think he's coming back. He's gone. He's not coming back. But they're not just fed up with waiting. They've actually got their own ideas. They've got a plan. They come to Aaron with their own plan. They want gods. They want him, Aaron, to make gods for them. God isn't working for them. They've tried waiting for Moses, who's God's representative. They've waited long enough, they feel, so they're going to do things their own way. Well, if God isn't doing things our own way, that's no excuse to do our own thing, as we'll see. And the great irony here is that while Moses is on the mountain and God is telling him exactly how to make the ark, the tabernacle, and all these things in great detail, the people decide they're going to make something else. They're going to make something completely different. They're going to make what they think is a god. So they're supposed to be using their gold to make the ark, to make all these fittings and the lampstand, these things that were symbolic of their relationship with the living God. Instead, they take their gold and they make a statue of a calf with it. Now, to understand what's going on here, we need to go back a little bit in Exodus. So turn with me back to Exodus and chapter 20. And you might want to keep a finger here because we will come back here. So it's page 130. I'm going to do the same. I'm going to put the children's talk in there. I don't need that anymore. So Exodus chapter 20. And if you look at verse 3, this is God speaking. And he says, you shall have no other gods before me. And then look a bit further down. In Exodus chapter 20, at verse 23, just over the page. Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold. So they're specifically told not to make a god out of gold And then a few chapters later, what do? They're making a god out of gold. They did not do what God commanded. It's as simple as that. God told them what to do or what not to do, and then they went and did it. Now, it's probably quite easy for us to point the finger and say, look, it's really obvious, Israelites. You should have done what you were supposed to. But maybe if we take a step back and think about our own lives, then we can probably think of plenty of times that we've not done what God's told us to do. We can think of plenty of times when we've had an angry outburst. Maybe you can think of that lustful look that you didn't mean to happen. Maybe you can think of that lie that just sort of slipped out. Even though we might be tempted to point our finger at the Israelites and say, you're so bad, well, let's think about ourselves and remember that we don't always do what God commands. And we can't plead that we don't know, because we do know what God commanded, just like the Israelites did. But what happens next? What's Aaron's response to this? You might think Aaron would be horrified by what they're suggesting. Aaron's the leader, after all. He's Moses' brother. He ought to be pretty close to knowing what the right thing to do is. Well, actually, no. He just goes along with it. We're not told of any resistance that he made. He just, a bit like Adam back in Genesis, if you remember the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, God tells them not to eat a fruit from a particular tree, and then the snake comes and the snake tempts Eve, and then Eve eats the fruit. And we're told that Adam was there all that time. Adam was there and he said nothing. Aaron's a bit like that. He doesn't do anything, or rather, actually, he actively supports their plan and carries it out. So in that sense, he's worse. I think Satan loves it when men don't take their responsibility. Aaron was the leader. He should have put a stop to this. He should have told them what a horrible thing they were trying to do. But he didn't. He wimped out of it. We need to pray for our men, that they will be men who take responsibility where they need to. We need to pray for AD and Johnny, don't we? Our leaders. May they never behave like Aaron behaves at this point. We need to pray for them. We need to pray that they would not be afraid to look unpopular. They'd not be afraid when they were faced by a group of people who's suggesting something that is disobedient to God. So Aaron takes their gold, and he melts it down, and he makes them a calf, we're told in verse 4. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. And then they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Just a note on the calf. We tend to think of a calf as being a baby cow, which it is, and tend to think it's quite cute because it's a baby animal, and baby animals are cute. But I've read that this word calf is not quite that sense. What it means is a young bull. So a bull is a really strong animal. It's like a symbol of strength. And then you've got a young bull, which is in the prime of its strength. So it's all about strength. The Egyptians were quite fond of worshipping bulls or images that were that looked like bulls. So that's the context of what he's made. And then look what they say in verse 4. They say, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. So that's, again, a great irony. How can they say that this thing they've just made is responsible for something that happened in the past? It doesn't make sense. There's no sense here. There's a lot of irony around what's happening. But also turn back to Exodus chapter 20, where you should still have your finger, and look at verse 2. And this will probably sound slightly familiar. This is God speaking. He says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. That's very similar, isn't it, to our verse 4. These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Except God speaks in the first place, and the calf obviously can't speak, so they speak on its behalf. So the calf can't speak, it doesn't know anything. It's about to be destroyed, and it doesn't see that coming. And the great irony is they're saying it brought them up out of Egypt, when really, if anything, they brought it out of Egypt. The calf is Egypt-inspired. They've seen or they remember the pagan gods and rituals of Egypt, and they've they've built this calf in the same way. And then Aaron, in verse 5, it says, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there'll be a festival to the Lord. Well, what do we make of that? So they're worshipping the statue, the idol of the calf, and then Aaron says, we're going to make sacrifices and have a festival to the Lord. What is going on? Is he trying to salvage this situation? Has he realized that they've turned to idolatry and he thinks, no, we've got to get back to the Lord? Or is he trying to legitimize what he's doing by using the Lord's name? Or is he actually saying that the calf is the Lord? What's going on? Well, either way, if we again go back to Exodus chapter 20, and this time look at verse 4, it says this, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So that's pretty clear, isn't it? So whatever Aaron's trying to do here, it's clear that that commandment is being broken. They shouldn't be bowing down to that calf, whether they think it's God or not. So God does not tolerate being associated with idols or images. So we need to not think that we can legitimize any idol by associating it with God. So to explain what I mean, I might say, I think God's given me a gift for playing golf. I don't think he has. But imagine I said this, and I think what I need to do actually is spend 4 hours a day playing golf. So after I finish work, I'm going to go straight to the golf course. I'm going to spend my 4 hours there, and then I'm going to go home. And my family are probably going to suffer from that a bit. I won't get to see my children much. But I really feel that I ought to glorify God through my golf skills. And that's really important. Well, I hope that if I said that, you would say to me, maybe I'm at risk of making an idol out of my golf there. Who am I kidding? Who would I be kidding? Probably none of you. And certainly not God. We can't kid God. We can't fool God by that, can we? By somehow associating him with our idols. And then verse 6, what happens next? Well, it's a downward spiral. They get up and they sacrifice burnt offerings, present their fellowship offerings, and afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. So I've read that revelry, that has sexual connotations. It looks as though they've started worshipping a pagan god, and now they're winding up entangled in pagan rituals as well. So the people were a far cry at this point from what they should have been as God's people. They've turned away from God. They're disobeying his commands. They're worshipping another god, a statue, and it culminates in an unruly mess. But meanwhile, look at verse 7, back up on the mountain where Moses is, God says this. He says, go down because your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt. God sees what's happening, unlike the calf doesn't know what's going on. God knows what's happening. God sees. We can't hide our sin. God knows exactly what's going on in our hearts, doesn't he? Just like he knew what the Israelites were doing then. And who of us can face that thought and declare ourselves innocent? God knows what's in our hearts. He knows our sin. And look at how God distances himself from the people already. He says to Moses, your people, whom you brought up out of Egypt. So the people did that, didn't they? They distanced themselves from God. Didn't mention his name. They said Moses brought them out. God actually does a similar thing here. He doesn't say my people. He doesn't say whom I brought out of Egypt. He's distanced himself from them. The relationship is at risk. And then look at verse 8. He says, they've been quick to turn away from what I commanded them. Contrast that with what you see in verse 1, where the people are saying, oh, Moses has been gone for ages. Actually, God says, it's pretty quick. It didn't take long for them to end up rebelling. So God knows exactly what they've done. And he says they've turned away from him. They've turned away from what he commanded them. The decisions that they've made, the things they've done, have amounted to a complete rejection of God as their God. Verse 9, again, I have seen these people. He knows their character, and he says they're stiff-necked. Stiff-necked people. That might not make immediate sense to us, because we sort of think, oh, I haven't slept very well, I've got a bit of a stiff neck. That's probably not what this is referring to, and I think it's speaking in a way that the Israelites would probably have understood quite well, but we maybe don't understand so well, which is that it's talking about an animal, the neck of an animal. So if you're trying to lead an animal like a horse or a cow, then what you have to do, I'm told, is you have to point the head of the animal, and then it will sort of go. So if you move it, it will just go where it's looking. And obviously if the animal doesn't want to go, if it's being stubborn, it stiffens its neck up, so you can't move it, so it won't, it's refusing to go in the direction that you're trying to take it. So God is saying these people are stubborn, they're stiff-necked, they're like a horse that cannot be led. They won't accept correction. And then verse 10, which is very sobering, this is God's anger. God threatens destruction. Rebellion leads to destruction. There will be consequences for Israel because of their sin. Complete destruction is threatened. God says he could kill all of them. I think around the world around us, a lot of the time thinks there won't be any consequences for sin. Don't you? You think of Prince Charles and adultery, or other people and adultery. People think, got away with it, nothing bad happened, there's no consequence. Or speeding. Bloomfield Road is 20 miles an hour now, which is ridiculous. But if you talk to someone on the street and say, oh, you know, went down there at 30, it was all right, the police didn't see me, there's no cameras there, you'll be all right. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that, is there? You didn't get caught. No one got hurt. You didn't hit any children. It's fine, isn't it? No one will catch you. Or that lustful look, you know, no one saw it. Doesn't matter, does it? There's no consequences. No one saw it. You didn't get caught. But we mustn't be drawn in by that. There is a God who takes sin seriously, and there will be consequences, as we will see, for sin. So you've seen about the sin, but secondly, there is one who intercedes. Look at verse 11. So verse 10, God says, leave me alone, that I might destroy them. Then look at verse 11. This is a brilliant verse. The story would end very differently apart from this verse. But Moses sought the favor of the Lord. He sought the favor of the Lord. When someone asks you to do them a favor, what that actually means is, if someone says to you, oh, can you do me a favor? They're not about to say, you do this for me and then later on I'll do something for you. They're asking you to do something for free. That's what a favor really is, isn't it? It's not something that's deserved. It's not something that's going to be paid back. What they deserve, what the people deserve, is destruction. And Moses knows that he needs God's favor. That's the only thing that will save them. And then he reminds God that these people are his people, whom he brought out of Egypt. Again, the irony, the people are saying the calf brought them out of Egypt. Moses is saying, no, you brought them out of Egypt, God. And then in verse 12, he says, God's name, God's glory would suffer if he destroyed them. And in verse 13, he talks about the promises that God made to his servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who was also called Israel. So Moses knew that he had to plead with God on the basis of God's character. There was no way that he could plead on the basis of the Israelites' good behavior. So sometimes you might hear about a prisoner, they had a long sentence, and then they get let out early because of good behavior. They behaved better than expected, so they're allowed out early. That's not going to work here, is it? That's clearly not going to work, and Moses knows it. He can't plead on the basis of the people's behavior. He can't even plead on the basis of his own character. He knows he was a sinner as well. Moses knew any mercy from God would have to be based on God's character and nothing else. And look at verse 14. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. So that can be a bit of a difficult concept. The Lord relented. Did he change his mind? What's going on here? I think this is difficult. We know that God is sovereign. We know that God is all-knowing. And the way this is described, you might think it's a bit like a conversation between people where someone is adamant that one thing is right or something is going to be done. And then someone else comes in and says, oh, but have you thought about this? And they say, oh, actually, no, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, no, you're right, I'm going to change my mind. That's clearly not what's happening here. That cannot be the case. It cannot be the case that God's forgotten about these points that Moses is raising. Or it can't be that he hadn't thought through the implications to the glory of his name. He says, ah, you make a really good point, Moses. You make a really good point. I shouldn't have said that. That can't be what's going on because of what we know about God. We're also told that God doesn't change his mind. You can read that in Numbers 23:19 or in 1 Samuel 15:29. But if you look back at verse 7, maybe this helps us a little bit. The first thing that happens is the Lord says to Moses, go down. So it almost seems as though God's intention was always for Moses to go down to the people. There would be no point in God saying to Moses to go down if there weren't going to be any people left to go down to. And then in verse 10 he says that I may destroy them. So the implication there is perhaps that if Moses hadn't pleaded, God would have destroyed the people. But surely it must have been God's will for Moses to plead. So I think this does hang together if we do some work to understand it. But it's not easy. But the point here is really that Moses turns away God's wrath by his intercession. And what is helpful is Psalm 106, which you might like to turn to, which comments on this incident. So in the Brown Bibles, it's page 659. And if we look at Psalm 106 and verse 19, it says this. It's talking about this incident that we're reading about. It says, at Horeb, they made a calf and worshipped an idol cast from metal. They exchanged their glory for the image of a bull which eats grass. They forgot the God who saved them, who had done great things in Egypt, miracles in the land of Ham, and awesome deeds by the Red Sea. So he said he would destroy them. Had not Moses, his chosen one, stood in the breach before him to keep his wrath from destroying them? So Moses stood in the breach, the gap, if you like, the gap between the people's disobedience and sin and God's perfect holiness. There was this gap. Moses stood in the breach, and it's clearly looking forward to Jesus there, isn't it? Who stood in the breach, Jesus who died in our place. So that gap, that breach between us in our imperfection and God in his perfection, that gap could be bridged. Jesus stood in the breach. So we cannot come to God on our own basis. We can only seek his favor, coming on the basis of his character and his words, and not our own. I think that's what we learn from this. But then, notice, there are still consequences. There are still consequences to the people's sin. So we read in verse 15, God has said he won't destroy the people. Moses starts going down the mountain. He's got the tablets. We're told they're the physical representation, if you like, at this point of God's covenant with his people. They're written by God. And then look at what happens in verse 19. He breaks them. He breaks the tablets to pieces. I don't think this is an angry gesture. You know, some people, when they get angry, throw things. I don't think that's quite the fullness of what's going on here. The tablets were this symbol of the relationship with God. And when he breaks them, I think that's symbolizing that the situation is so serious that God's covenant, God's relationship with his people is at risk because of the sin, because of the rebellion. So the tablets are in pieces. And then the calf gets broken into pieces, doesn't it? Look at verse 20. Moses breaks it in pieces, grinds it to powder, and scatters it on the water, makes the people drink it. So interestingly, what Moses does is what he's supposed to do. If you look back at chapter 23 and verse 24, they're supposed to break in pieces the foreign gods. And that's what Moses does. He does the right thing where the Israelites were doing the wrong thing. So the calf wasn't really a god. It didn't last very long. It couldn't save itself from Moses destroying it, let alone save anyone else out of Egypt. So he makes them drink it. He makes them drink the powdered calf in the water. And I think the point there is they have to take responsibility. They have to drink the fruit of their sin. And then he goes to Aaron. Aaron is the leader. He's the first one who has to answer to Moses about what's going on. And look at how Aaron tries to cover up. He tries to blame the people. He says, these people, it's their fault. You know how prone these people are to evil. It's just like Adam, isn't it, in the garden. Remember Adam in the Garden of Eden? Adam tries to blame Eve. Then Eve blames the serpent. It's the blame game. Aaron is playing the same game years later. But he can't cover up. Even his ridiculous lie in verse 24, his suggestion that actually he just threw the gold in the fire and then, whoops, here's a calf. That's not going to work, is it? But the tragedy is that's the best he can do. On his own, that's the best he can do. On our own, that's the best we can do, is just to try to cover up our guilt. Hope no one notices. Lie, try and cover it up. But we've got no hope, have we, with God? God's seen. God's already told Moses. Moses knows what's happening. Verse 25, the verdict is Aaron is still responsible. Verse 25, Aaron had let them get out of control. He doesn't get off the hook. He's still responsible. So the people are there. They're out of control. We're told they're running wild. So worship of this false god has led them into chaos. And they're a laughingstock to their enemies, we're told. So instead of defeating them, which we're told is what God intended in chapter 23, they were going to defeat their enemies. That passage about the victory as they're going into the promised land, instead they're a laughingstock to their enemies. So imagine these people are running around all over the camp, things are going on that shouldn't be going on, who knows what it would look like. And in the midst of this, Moses stands at the entrance of the camp, in verse 26, and makes this call for obedience to God. And the Levites come, and then in verse 27, God says, strap a sword to his side, go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother, his friend, and his neighbor. Now that's a tricky verse, isn't it, to come to as Christians. We might find it easier to preach, I certainly would, on this passage if that wasn't there. But we can't escape that. We can't pretend it's not there. I think we have to remember when we look back earlier on, we look back at verse 10, God was ready to kill them all. All the people could have been dead if Moses hadn't pleaded with him. So in a way, this is a lot more merciful than what could have happened. We read elsewhere that there's quite a lot of Israelites, and 3,000 is not very many. Not saying that each one of those wasn't a tragic death, but it could have been a lot worse. It could have been tens or hundreds of thousands of dead. But 3,000 dead. And then we assume that after 3,000 people had died, then perhaps everyone else calmed down or realized how serious this sin was. Verse 28, the Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. That's the deadly and horrific consequences of sin. And yet it's merciful compared to that complete destruction. And then verse 29, we're told the Levites are set apart because they were against their brothers, but they were for God that day. Well, I think we have to be careful that we don't take this literally and decide we need to go out with our swords and start striking people. Hopefully it's pretty clear to us that that's not how we need to apply this passage. I think at the very least what we can say is that we are to take sins inside God's community very seriously, especially the sin of idolatry, aren't we? We need to be, I think, ready to rebuke each other. We need to be ready that church discipline ought to exist. And sometimes there is pain, isn't there, involved in dealing with sin. It says in Proverbs 27 that wounds from a friend can be trusted. Maybe that's something similar to what's going on here. These 3,000 dead probably helped everyone else to think, this isn't the way we should be going. We need to stop. We need to ask for forgiveness. So then Moses says, look at verse 30, he says, the next day Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. So Moses goes on behalf of the people to make atonement. And look, he doesn't try to hide like Aaron. He goes to God and he said, "What a great sin these people have committed." Verse 31. He confesses their sin. There's no point trying to deny it. And then verse 32, Moses offers to pay for their sin. But he can't. He can't. The sinner must pay for their sin. Only Jesus could really pay for the sin of others. And where Moses says, "Perhaps I can make atonement," we know that Jesus really can make atonement, a sure atonement, not just a perhaps, not just a perhaps we can be forgiven. When Jesus died on the cross, it was a certainty. Atonement was made. There is no perhaps about it, and there's no perhaps about it if we trust in Jesus today. So there is, we have no hope in ourselves at escaping the consequences of sin. The guilt remains. But on the other hand, there is hope in God. He is merciful in not treating the people here as their sins deserve. And the passage ends in a note of hope and also a note of sadness. So the big question now is, what's going to happen to the people? What's going to happen to their journey to the promised land? What's going to happen to this covenant, this relationship with God? Is it on or is it off? What's going to happen? Verse 34, "Now go, lead the people to the place I spoke of." So the good news is, it's still on. They're still going to be his people. They're still going to go to the promised land, but God won't let their sin go unpunished. He will punish them. And then verse 35, the plague came. And presumably some of them died. And we need to remember as well that we read that all of that generation died in the desert. They didn't go into the promised land because of this and other incidents. So sin is destructive and it is futile. But there is one who intercedes on our behalf. Sin does have consequences. We need to remember those things. So when someone says it's important to have some kind of faith, but we all worship the same God, or it doesn't matter what you believe, so long as you don't hurt anyone. Or if someone says, "God hasn't done anything for me, why should I pay any attention to him?" Well, we've seen that God does not tolerate rivals. It doesn't matter. It does matter very much how you treat God, regardless of whether you're hurting any other human beings. And there is an urgent need to pay attention to God, whether or not you perceive that he's done you any favors. Not because of that, but because of the judgment that we'll all face. And it has everything to do with the salvation that is available in Jesus. So as we finish, let's turn to 1 Corinthians and chapter 9, which is a comment from the New Testament on what happened here in Exodus. So if you've got a brown Bible, it's page 1202. I'm going to read from verse 24. This is Paul writing. He says, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others I will not myself be disqualified for the prize." And then he starts to talk about Israel's history. "For I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud, and they all passed through the sea." That's in Exodus. "They were all baptized in Moses, in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, God was not pleased with most of them. Their bodies were scattered over the desert. Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry." And then later on in verse 11 he says, "These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. So Paul exhorts us, if you think you're standing firm, be careful. These were God's people. They might have thought they were standing firm, but they weren't. And then finally, remembering the words of Psalm 106, it says, so he said he would destroy them, had not Moses, his chosen one, stood in the breach before him to keep his wrath from destroying them. And in the same way, we've turned away from God, so he would destroy us, had not Jesus, his chosen one, stood in the breach to keep his wrath from destroying us. Let's pray. Father, thank you for Jesus. Thank you that Jesus stood in the breach. Lord, thank you that because of him, we might not be destroyed. And we recognize that without him, in our sin, we could not face you. We are no better than those Israelites. Lord, so often we turn away from the things you've commanded us. We go our own way. We want to make our own idols. But Lord, thank you for that glorious, glorious truth that Jesus stood in the breach to keep your wrath from destroying us. Lord, please help us to trust in Jesus. Please help us to lean heavily on him, to rely on him alone for our salvation. Please help us never to depart from that place of trusting in Jesus. Amen.